Okay, we'll bring the meeting of the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Task Force, or Committee, I should say, to order and start out with a roll call.
Cornish.
Here.
Woodard.
Here.
Mullery. Gothier.
Here.
Grunhagen.
Here.
Hilty. Johnson.
Here.
Kelly. Kiefer.
Here.
Kreisel.
Here.
Leidiger.
Here.
Mariani. McDonald.
Here.
Moran.
Here.
Nornis. Slocum. Smith.
Hey, a quorum present. If somebody wants to entertain a motion here for April 26th, committee meeting notes. Representative Johnson moves the minutes of April 26th for our committee. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. Today we'll start out with House File 1289, Representative Mack. Representative Mack, I'll move House File 1289 to be recommended to pass and move to the General Register. Do you have any amendments?
We do not have any amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Mack, if you want to state your name and begin with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I am Tara Mack and here to present House File 1289. Members, this is a bill to expand the operating parameters for transit bus operation on highway shoulders. In just a few days, construction will begin on the Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit shoulder lanes. When the construction is complete in 2012, Cedar Avenue BRT vehicles will travel on the shoulders of Cedar Avenue from Lakeville to the Mall of America, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. This project is necessary to alleviate the congestion in this heavily used corridor. It is estimated that by 2030, this line will provide the same commuter capacity as an additional 1.5 lanes of highway. Additional capacity in this corridor is not in MnDOT's future plans for this corridor, and even if they were to be built, the Cedar Avenue Bridge cannot carry additional lanes without major reconstruction. This expanded authority provided in this bill will not help just the Cedar BRT line, but other transit lines in Minnesota. I have with me this morning Dakota County Commissioner Nancy Schuweiler, who would also like to testify in support of House File 1289.
Okay, ma'am, do you state your name and title and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Commissioner Nancy Schuweiler from Dakota County, and I appreciate the opportunity to express Dakota County's support for House File 1289. This enabling legislation provides an important tool that can be used to improve the efficiency of transit operations on bus shoulders around the Twin Cities region. It proposes three changes to the existing bus shoulder use laws. It would allow local road authorities to operate bus shoulder lanes in addition to MnDOT, and it could allow buses to operate on shoulders for expanded hours of operation and potentially operate up to the posted speed limit of the adjacent roadway. These changes would need to be based on findings of an engineering study and approval by the Commissioner of Transportation. This bill is consistent with recent efforts to maximize the operation of our regional transportation system with safe, cost-effective management techniques. Such flexibility to maximize the operation of bus shoulders may not only benefit existing use by express buses where conditions warrant such changes, but will also be important to maximize operations for the region's highway shoulder running bus rapid transit. The region's first two BRT lines, Cedar Avenue and I-35W, which will both serve Dakota County, will begin operation in 2012. As gas prices skyrocket and dollars remain limited to make major expansion improvements to our highway system, these BRT lines will provide a convenient, fast, and cost-effective alternative to these congested highways. Specifically, on the portion of Cedar Avenue under Dakota County jurisdiction, the bus shoulders have been engineered to provide a 12-foot paved surface that provides for both the bus use and emergency use without the need for separate additional lanes, and the associated right-of-way acquisition, property impacts, or construction cost. This approach is based on MnDOT's 20 years of experience safely and successfully operating a bus shoulder system that now totals about 300 miles across the Twin Cities region. It is desired to run station-to-station bus vehicles as all-day service, utilizing these shoulder lanes without the need to weave into and out of regular traffic lanes. The speed limit provisions of this legislation may allow the buses to run at the 40 or 45 mile per hour posted speed of adjacent travel lanes rather than the current 35 miles per hour to minimize the travel times for station-to-station service. Travel times are a critical factor in the eventual success of BRT as riders seek a service that is quick and efficient and an alternative to their personal vehicles. Of course, safety is the primary concern of any transportation agency, and that is certainly the case here. The proposed changes are only enabling and require engineering study by the Road Authority in cooperation with the transit provider, followed by the concurrence of the Commissioner of Transportation. This is a similar approach to how speed limits are set today and ensures important factors specific to the bus shoulders and questions will be considered before any changes are made. In closing, I would like to thank Commissioner Sorrell and his MnDOT staff for their hard work in preparing this bill and their efforts to help improve operations of shoulder running BRT and bus services in the region. I ask the committee for your support of this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from members yet? If not, we'll move on to the next testifier, Ms. Cassandra Isaacson, MnDOT. While you're getting ready, there is any opposition to the bill in the crowd? Testify. Okay, go ahead, ma'am. Your name.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm the Assistant State Traffic Engineer. And I just wanted to let the committee know that currently we have about nearly 300 miles of bus shoulders in the state of Minnesota. And they've been in operation for nearly two decades. They have an exemplary safety record. When bus shoulders were first proposed more than 20 years ago, traffic engineers were very concerned about safety. And so much of the current operations was to address those concerns. Now that we have 20 years of experience with bus shoulder operations, we feel confident that we can make adjustments to operations based on engineering and traffic studies similar to the way we do other things. And I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have regarding the safety of those shoulders.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from members at this point? Any questions from members about the bill at all in its content? If not, Representative Mack, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair. Just thank you so much for the time. Thank you, members, and we sure appreciate your support.
Okay, Representative Mack, the Chair will move House File 1289 to recommend it to pass and move to the General Register. Any comments or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Okay. This goes to GovOps.
Chairman Cornish, welcome to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 1577 be recommended to pass and be referred to the GovOps Committee.
Okay, Mr. Cornish, to your bill.
Members, this is, I believe, the same bill that we have included in our omnibus public safety bill. I believe everybody was in favor of it, and there was some talk about the content that was passed out, but there was some people that wanted to add more things. At this point, I'm not inclined to accept any amendments, except a few people that have come to me about adding certain advocacy groups. I think, Mr. Chair and members, if I could ask you to ask Ms. Pirius to offer one oral amendment that we talked about before committee.
Okay, do you have the oral amendment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cornish, just to make sure you're referring to Clause 9 in the probation officer?
Say that again?
Clause 9, the probation officers?
Yes, that one.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, line 10, after corrections, insert in consultation with local corrections associations.
Okay, is that sound right, Chairman Cornish?
Yes, that's meant to give, there's a three-tiered system, the probation, and after consultation with them, he'll pick the, that'll give them each an equal shot at talking to the commissioner and see who should be on the committee. That's the only amendment I have at this time.
Okay, is there any discussion about the amendment? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure I'm looking at the right bill. I see there's
a delete all.
There's a delete all, and there's
we're on the original amendment, Representative Johnson. And we don't have the amendments are not before. I'm sorry, the original bill. The amendments have not been discussed.
Okay.
So this is an oral amendment to the original bill.
Oral amendment.
Any discussion? Okay, Ms. Pritis, could you repeat that for us so we're all on the same page?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, Representative Cornish moves to amend House File 1577 as introduced on page 2, line 10. After corrections, insert in consultation with local corrections associations.
Okay, hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, amendment passes. Do you have any testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, I think there was the one, Ms. Reed is in here. If she could come up, there was one.
What's that? Carolyn Palmer.
Okay.
Thank you and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, members of the committee, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I just would like to make a very brief comment. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Cornish for his efforts to broaden the discussion on sex offender policy, and we do think that the task force is a good idea. The only thing we would like the committee to consider is adding some sort of representation on the task force from a sexual assault advocate or victim services organization. A victim's report is certainly very important to the investigation and prosecution of criminal sexual conduct cases, and we think that it would be helpful for the task force participants to hear from victims and about their experiences in the system. The other thing I would just like to add is that the victim perspective has been added in other relevant situations. MnCASA had a representative on Governor Pawlenty's Commission on Sex Offender Policy a few years ago. Currently, state law does mandate a victim services professional participate in all end of confinement reviews when sex offenders are assigned a risk level. And in some other states, such as Washington State, they do have representation from the State Sexual Assault Coalition on their sex offender policy board. So with that, we just would hope the committee would consider adding representation from an advocacy program or victim services program to the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the members? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, ma'am. Additional testifiers?
Mr. Chair and members, I think what I'm more than likely do is this is going to GovOps, and so after their testimony today, probably write something up and amend it in GovOps with, because I think NAMI, the Association for Mental Illness, also wants an advocate. So we'll look at the various requests and probably add them in GovOps. So go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Cornish and Mr. Chair. Melissa Reed with the City of Minneapolis. We'd like to echo the thanks to Representative Cornish for bringing this issue to the forefront to the committee. The City of Minneapolis is very happy at this opportunity to look at this issue in greater depth. Over the last few years, as a result of some various Supreme Court decisions, some policy changes at the Department of Corrections, the City of Minneapolis, as well as I would also say probably the City of St. Paul, has experienced a significant increase in the the number of high-level sex offenders living in our communities. They're coming from other communities, and we're experiencing a significant overburden factor. In North Minneapolis, for example, within two zip codes in North Minneapolis, 50% of the state's level three sex offenders live in two zip codes in North Minneapolis. And they don't originate from these communities. So we're happy at the opportunity to participate in this task force, and the only suggestions that we brought to Representative Cornish were to include an examination of the overburden factor when this task force does convene, and to look at the reasons why that's happening, and to look at some possible policy solutions to that. And then the only other suggestion we offered was in looking at the supervision and the release planning, how decisions are made as to where offenders will reside when they leave incarceration, if they go back to their county of commit or if they have the opportunity to go somewhere else. The somewhere else has tended to be St. Paul and Minneapolis. And so we're hoping that we can look at the release planning and have some shared analysis between Department of Corrections counties and Community Corrections Act counties, because both of those counties have experienced the release planning in different ways. So we would just add that to the mix, and we again appreciate the committee's consideration and Representative Cornish's time bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Any questions from the members? Okay. Well, Representative Maury?
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't have a question. I guess that's just Ms. Reed. Is speaking mainly to the DE1 amendment and why it is here. So we can bring that up in a few minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mulroney. Is there any other members of the public who would like to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Okay. Seeing none. Representative Mulroney, I know that there's a couple of amendments here. Would anyone like to move these amendments?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the DE1, and basically I agree completely with Chairman Cornish that we need this task force on sex offender policy. Just about everybody in the system thinks we need to start having a more logical and research-based policy towards this issue. And basically, we're pretty close on the task forces and everything, but partly because of Ms. Reed's testimony, or not because of her testimony, but because of that issue, and some other issues that have been brought to me by people working on sex offenders, I thought that we needed to specify some of the particulars that have been brought to me as things that this task force needed to look into. So that's why I have a few things more in the mix than Chair Cornish's.
Okay, Representative Maury moves the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Chair Cornish?
I would rather not put this on the bill and just talk about it between here and GovOps. I've crafted this House File 1577 in our other bill and this one to specific reasons and purposes, and that's why I'm not adding a number of other people that want to be on it to keep it smaller and keep the direction more focused. And so at this time, I'd rather not accept the amendment and then look at it between now and GovOps for some choice words here to amend the engrossed bill rather than a complete new DE1.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, between that time, would you be willing to look at a citizen representation to be appointed to that commission? I think we're pretty heavy with professionals, but we don't have a public member that I can see.
Chair,
so I'm wondering if you'd be amenable to looking at that.
I sure would be amenable, Mr. Chair and Representative Gauthier. The problem is, I suppose, how would you pick a citizen that naturally, I don't know if you have an interview panel to find out which end of the
spectrum. I have a suggestion.
So. But I'm sure I would look at that between now and next committee.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maury?
I guess what Chairman Cornish said worries me, in that he plans to narrow this to, and which concerns me more than if he had said we plan to look at all the issues and didn't want to specify. By narrowing it, does that that seems to indicate that the issues that are in the DE1 amendment aren't what Representative Cornish or Chair Cornish wants, and it would maybe exclude what Ms. Reed mentioned as problems. So I guess my question of Representative Cornish, does he plan to have it more expansive, more like the DE1, or does he plan to do what he just said, which is to have it narrow?
Chair Cornish?
Mr. Chair and members, I guess my answer is that I've crafted this with a specific idea and purpose in mind, and my experience with task forces like PrimNet, and where you got 100 people sitting around in a room and addressing 200 issues, is that it goes on and on and on, and you never get anything done. That's what I meant by more narrowly focused rather than broadened out and trying to include every subject in the world. And so I figure I hit the high points here and add some more people to it. But if we get branching out too far, it'll be like the 27-25 work group that met last year, issue after issue, and then basically came up to not much of an agreement. So that's what I mean by more narrowly focused. And some of these points that are brought up, these other items will naturally come up. We're not limiting anybody what they can talk about at the thing. We're just directing them to the main points. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, as I told you at the time when the whatever that number was, Senate File 2527 or whatever it was, I thought that was going to be a fiasco at the time the way it was set up. And but I think that the issues Ms. Reed brought up are very serious issues the state should be looking into. And would it be your intention not to cover those then, or to cover those?
Chair Cornish?
Since it's I'm the author of the bill, it would be my intention to cover them the way that I think they should be covered in consultation with Ms. Reed, and I plan on inserting that, but just not everything in the world. I want to be very selective about what we add, because each committee and each addition we do ends up into so many more weeks of meetings. Every subject you put on a task force, they don't just bring it up and talk about it for 5 minutes. So, like I said, the Association of Mental Illness Group and the advocacy groups, I'll talk with them between now and add people in with precision.
Okay, any further discussion on the DE1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The noes have it. The amendment is not approved. There are additional amendments. Anyone would like to move the additional amendments? Representative Maury?
Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment. This was already accepted by the committee and put in the omnibus bill, and my understanding from Ms. Peary is it's exactly the same language, and apparently the reason that we're doing anything on any of these this morning is apparently the language is going to come out of the omnibus bill or something. I don't know why else we would be doing the sex offender task force. So as we've discussed all session, we need to start looking into our whole treatment of the juvenile justice system and start using the research that's working around the rest of the country. And so I think we need the task force. This committee supported it and put it in the omnibus bill, and so I just think we should be doing that also. I don't think we need hours of testimony like we had before on it.
Right, Representative Mulray moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Chair Cornish?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Mulray, this has been a major goal of mine this year and a major focus, and that's why I attended the legislative auditor's hearing on the sex offender program. And I want to keep it the same subject. I haven't got any plans on pulling out the language we had on juvenile justice or fender reentry or anything that we have in the omnibus bill now. It's just that I want a separate track, my own bill, or my own idea that I was responsible for in the Sex Offender Policy Task Force, and possibly merge it with others that I heard out there. And so I don't want to coagulate it, or whatever the word would be, with offender reentry and juvenile justice reform. I'd rather keep it just to my focus on the Sex Offender Policy Task Force. So, nothing against your amendments or your direction here, but I would just want to keep it my bill as it is.
Any further discussion of the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The noes have it, and the amendment, the A1 amendment, does not pass. There's an additional amendment. Representative Morey.
Mr. Chairman, I can kind of see where this is going, but I still think that people need to point out where something is needed. The offender reentry is an enormous issue. Almost everybody in the whole law enforcement system says we have to do something on this. There's huge studies nationally that show that we're really out of touch with a lot of it. We just had the Pew study, which shows we have the most recidivism, and there's two reasons for that. One is the high high level of criminal we put away, but the other is the fact that we have our way behind on our reentry system, and we need to start doing something about this. And so I know that this is not a problem as far as the single subject rule, which Representative Cornish mentioned. So it's just another effort to try to make the state look into the fact that we are failing to protect the citizens of Minnesota by not starting to follow national research and results on reentry.
Representative Mulry moves the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Would you like me to repeat your retort, Chairman Cornish? Or?
As before, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Mulry, I would like to keep my bill the way it is on this subject of the sex offender. And I don't agree with some of the statements you've made, but it's just not my desire to create a whole other task force on this subject right now, at least under my direction on this bill.
Okay, any further discussion regarding the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The noes have it, and the amendment, A2 amendment, does not pass. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of, well, renew your motion, Chair Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd renew the motion. House File 1577 be recommended to pass and move to GovOps.
House File 1577, the motion has been renewed as amended and recommended to go to GovOps. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The ayes have it. House File 1577 is moved to the Government Ops Committee.
Well, we're going to be here a while.
Okay, members, next we'll move to House File 358, Representative Barrett. You can bring your testifiers up now or later, up to you. The chair will move House File 358 be recommended pass and move to the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Bill Barrett, your bill is before us. How would you like to proceed?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'd like to just go over the bill for a moment, talk about it, tell you what it does and what it doesn't do, and explain the reason I think this bill is important. First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, certainly about this bill, which is loosely defined as a sanctuary city bill. I know this subject is important. There are a lot of people here to testify, both in favor and against. I appreciate everyone's thoughts on the issue. The issue has been around our country for a long, long time, both from a federal, state, and local level. A lot of people have good thoughts, both for and against. And so I would hope today, as we talk about this issue, we talk about it in a respectful way so that we can understand what this bill does and why we might want to adopt it in our state. First of all, Mr. Chair, this bill supports the federal laws related to illegal immigration, specifically the 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which mandates that local officials not restrict the sharing of information about illegal immigration with federal authorities. Also, it supports Title 8, Section 1373, and Title 8, Section 1644. The bill is not anti-immigrant. Quite the contrary, this bill supports immigration that happens throughout the current legal processes that our country has had in place for hundreds of years, and that supports immigration to our country. A couple thoughts I have regarding the bill. Certainly one thing we can take away from the tragic events of September 11, 2001 is that communication between the different branches of government is critically important for the security of our citizens, and the lack of communication between jurisdictions results in tragedy. Many counties in our state are spending millions of dollars to improve communication by purchasing 800 megahertz radio devices to be used for better communication. Communication is critically important, as we have seen. This bill allows for better communication between the various agencies related to a very important issue in our state. The current situation in our country regarding illegal immigration is confusing enough without having separate policies that collectively further confuse the issue. As other states, such as Georgia, Florida, and Arizona, enact laws that support the rights of their citizens and support federal laws, the worry I have is that the sanctuary that is communicated by our current local policies will attract more people to our state, which places a tremendous burden on our state. Studies suggest that the total cost of illegal immigration in our country is over $100 billion. Because of the clandestine nature of the issue, no one knows for sure what the real number is. There are costs related to education, human services, criminal justice that are real. As we all know, we have a $5 billion budget deficit in our state, and we are having trouble meeting the needs of our citizens. Department of Justice data says that 17% of those people incarcerated in federal prisons are Mexican citizens. About 50% of these offenses committed are drug-related. Meth is imported to the United States over the borders, mostly our southern border, as are other drugs. There's a handout you should have in your packet that highlights some of the issues related to drug trafficking in the United States. There are drug tunnels built between our southern border all the time. They're found all the time. And the amount of drugs imported into our country is huge. It has a tremendous societal problem. We have many good prevention and treatment programs in our country. One thing we have not done is prevent illegal drugs from coming into our country. Drug use and abuse in our country is out of control and affecting people of all races, ages, and genders. Not doing everything possible to support federal laws related to illegal immigration has a profound effect on this issue. This issue was brought to me by many people in my county and around the state as I've campaigned for office last year. We've had bills before this body, and certainly some of them have went through on bipartisan support. I think one a couple years ago was tied, 67-67, if I remember correctly. So what I want to do is highlight the issue as a public policy person. This is a huge public policy issue in our state, in our country, and I'm here to support this bill and to urge the support of our committee here. There's no other questions at this point. I'd like to ask Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek to come and talk today about his perspective working with cities who have sanctuary city policies and those that do not have sanctuary city policies.
Good morning, Sheriff Stanek. Good to have you here again. If you could state your name and title and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair members. My name is Richard Stanek. I'm Sheriff in Hennepin County. Mr. Chair members, Representative Barrett, look, I came this morning to give you a little bit of a perspective about running a local jail, a jail with a population of about 40,000 inmates per year in a county with about 1.3 million residents, 47 different municipalities, and 37 local law enforcement agencies. Some of those local law enforcement agencies have sanctuary city ordinances. Some do not. But again, I want to give you a little bit of perspective about what happens once they get past that point and make it to a jail setting. Mr. Chair, members, about 5 years ago, this committee issued a report with data from the Minnesota Department of Corrections, which showed that one out of every 16 inmates in Minnesota prisons was an undocumented person. And that report showed that over 500 foreign nationals from Minneapolis and St. Paul had been convicted of felonies, including child molestation, drug trafficking, rape, and murder. And you and your fellow legislators must decide on the policy as proposed by this House file this morning, whether to prohibit the so-called sanctuary city policies in the state of Minnesota or not. It's a worthy discussion to have a public policy debate on. I'm here to tell you how the Hennepin County Jail deals with the bookings of thousands of foreign individuals every year in our county. Now, our sheriff's office operates the Adult Detention Center, otherwise known as the jail. We're located in downtown Minneapolis, just a few blocks west of the Metrodome. Now, all municipalities located in Hennepin County book arrestees into the Hennepin County Jail. And like I mentioned, we book approximately 40,000 or so folks every year. It should be noted that there are 17 cities in the county that also have their own local lockup facility, which means out of those 37 agencies, 17 of them have local holding cells that they can hold individuals for anywhere from 4 to maybe 24, 36 hours before booking them into the Hennepin County Jail. These 17 municipalities combined booked an additional 8,800 folks in 2010. So the 40,000 that get booked in downtown on top of the 8,800 that are booked in these local holding facilities. Now, the city of Minneapolis does not have their own lockup, and they bring all their arrestees to the Hennepin County Jail. Mr. Chair, members, you know, when a booking process begins of these 40,000 persons, each and every inmate is asked where they were born. It's part of the booking sheet. It's been there for years. There's a number of reasons why we ask that. And out of these 40,000 or so bookings every year, 4,500 claim to be foreign-born as self-reported. In 2010, these 4,500 folks were brought to our jail in Minneapolis by over 30 different law enforcement agencies. So regardless of where they were arrested, whether it was Minneapolis, Bloomington, Minnetonka, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, Richfield, when they're booked into the Hennepin County Jail as part of our standard operating procedure, including mugshots and fingerprints, all inmates are asked their place of birth. And there are different organizations that need this information for different reasons that are not related to immigration. Now, for example, the jail is required to notify certain consulates if one of their citizens has been booked into jail. There are no less than 58 of those consulates that require notification when a foreign-born individual is booked into the Hennepin County Jail or any of the other jails across Minnesota. Now, for example, Mr. Chair, members, if someone from the African nation of Nigeria is arrested and booked in the jail, the Nigerian consulate wants to know, and we're required to notify them in a very timely fashion so they can adequately represent and make contact with that individual if they wish. The person who was arrested might get a visit from the consulate, might not. The same is also true for Costa Rica and Belize, China, Poland, and a long list of other countries. Now, the vast majority of these 4,500 people who claim to be foreign-born were arrested for crimes not related to immigration, and they were arrested by local law enforcement agencies. They're being booked into the Hennepin County Jail and awaiting trial or sentencing or released back out on bail. They may be felony level, they may be crimes of violence, they may be misdemeanors like DUI or domestic assault. If an inmate needs an interpreter, now we provide interpreter phone service that covers all the languages we've encountered. For example, if the inmate is a Hmong person, we have access to interpreters that can speak all the different dialects from Cambodia and Laos, Korea, and other countries where they may have lived. And for those inmates who state they're foreign-born, we then advise them that we're connecting them for an interview with an agent from the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or what's known in the federal government as ICE, I-C-E. And if they agree, we'll then call ICE to set up that interview. If they refuse to be interviewed, then we placed in detention like any other person. Now, we then contact ICE, and they may fax over a detainer, which is a document authorizing the detention of that person until the inmate's status can be determined. As one of the largest detention facilities in the upper Midwest, ICE agents visit our jail every weekday to review the booking sheets, to interview inmates, and to transfer foreign nationals to federal detention in another county. The ICE agents provide their own interpreters for the interviews. Mr. Chair, members, I want to be clear that the Hennepin County Jail, Sheriff's Office Jail, we don't hold federal detainees. We transport or require that they be transported to another holding facility that does have a contract with the federal government. Mr. Chair, members, out of those 4,500, again, we receive about 85 inmates a year who are not wanted for other crimes but are brought to us under INS hold-only orders or are taken into custody because they've completed their court cases. The prosecutor may have dropped the charges or the person may be acquitted. And these 85 inmates on the INS hold-only orders are with us for about 1.6 days on average, about a day and a half, because they're taken to other jails with contracts to hold the federal inmates pending resolution of those detainers. Mr. Chair, members, the strong partnerships across local, state, and federal law enforcement are important. I know there's a number of other law enforcement officers in the room, and we really stress this, that our partnerships with our federal, state, local law enforcement is important. And that was part of the 9/11 Commission recommendations, that we don't want silos of information. If someone is arrested for committing crimes in Hennepin County and booked into the Hennepin County Jail, they'll be checked out by our federal agencies. We partner with ICE just as we partner with the FBI or the Secret Service or the Department of Homeland Security. And Mr. Chair, members, now, well, we're a nation of immigrants. Make no mistake about it. I recently wrote about my grandfather. I had a chance to work on a project with my 15-year-old daughter. And my grandfather, Stanley, who came to Minneapolis from Poland and worked in a foundry in northeast Minneapolis, Representative Mullery, Joe, not far from your house, actually. And for immigrant communities, you and I have talked about this before, for immigrant communities, the criminal justice system can seem very confusing and intimidating. And that's why I'm working to reach out to so many groups of new Minnesotans. Now, we've created a community services unit that meets regularly with leaders of these communities. You know, we give them jail tours. We explain our process. We listen to their concerns and guidance on how to provide due process and basic compassion, dignity, and respect about how we do our business when they're booked into the Hennepin County Jail and what it is that they expect. We also hold mini academies for ethnic groups to explain how the sheriff's office works, with an eye toward recruiting the first-generation deputies for Hmongs and Somalis, Latinos, and others who are adding to the strength of our county, a very diverse county. You'll have to decide, like I said, Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Barrett's legislation about what is the public policy. But I'm glad to see that the public policy discussion is taking place in a forum such as this, that the people elected you to have these very basic discussions and important discussions, as I think you're going to hear from a number of folks who want to testify here this morning. Mr. Chair, members, I will be here for a while. I know you probably want to take some other testifiers. If you have questions for me, I'm happy to come back up.
Thank you, Sheriff Stanek. Any questions so far from the committee? Representative Mariani and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, former Representative Stanek. Can you tell us what is the, so you gave us the total number of foreign-born inmates, and were those Hennepin County numbers, one, and then two, what is the total inmate count in that jurisdiction?
Sure.
That references, that right. Connects to the 4,500.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Mariani, it's great to see you as well. Hennepin County Jail books, on average, 41,000 people a year through the jails. Those are booked by the local law enforcement agencies in our county, and sometimes federal agencies, sometimes the Minnesota State Patrol, but about 40,000 to 41,000. And of those, 4,500 of those folks self-report that they are foreign-born.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stanek, that tracks with my former Representative Stanek. That tracks with with the information I have about the diversity of our state. I think basically we're roughly running around with over 10% of Minnesotans are immigrants. I don't know what the foreign-born number of that is. I have quite a few citizens in my district, mostly from Southeast Asia and Latin America, who are foreign-born, but who have been citizens for quite a while. So the 4,500 number roughly makes sense to me, because that, you know, would be an equivalent to 10% of what you're currently booking. And then you stated earlier you've got 500 convicted felons who are undocumented persons. And I know we're going to, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to belabor this because we're going to hear lots of testimony here, but it seems to me that what we're hearing early on here in Sheriff Stanek's testimony, obviously is a sharing of the numbers as it relates to corrections in Hennepin County. But I just want to offer that I think what we're also hearing is that we have a system that currently works pretty well. If we're capturing 500 folks who are felons, who are undocumented, and we're convicting them, it seems to me like we've got a pretty effective system. And I think as we continue forward with this policy and any other policy, we always want to be able to ask the question, are we going to do harm to a system that is currently being effective? But it's good to see you again, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
And Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Sheriff Stanek. I guess first thing I'd like to say is that just the term sanctuary city, it's not a very accurate term. It's more of a pejorative term. These are separation ordinance would be the correct term when we look at these issues. So that's one point. That a question for you is, do you see a downside to our local law enforcement officers being required to engage in the kind of immigration work that questioning and so forth that this bill is directing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Johnson, I appreciate the correction about a separation ordinance. It's just a sanctuary cities is a term I think that kind of got labeled out there. If that's not accurate, I apologize, but try and use the right one that that meets the committee's needs. In terms of your question, there are really two things. Again, from my perspective, being a sheriff in a large metropolitan county, having a lot of cities, a lot of law enforcement agencies, some with separation ordinances, some without. Two things. One, I'm keenly concerned about the sharing of information amongst local, federal, state, county law enforcement agencies. And then secondly is really the issue of, you know, what is being told or directed to those local law enforcement officials, whether it's the chiefs of police or the line officers or those deputies, from their local elected officials about what they can and can't enforce in terms of laws. Again, I don't have a purview over that. I'm simply telling you what we do from the jail perspective, kind of the end of the process, but I didn't want there to be any mystery about that.
I'll pass.
Representative Mullery, Representative Mullery, and then Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I wonder where this is all going, since you mentioned requesting who's foreign-born. As you know, you grew up and I grew up in north and northeast, as you called it, northeast Minneapolis, which was the two places that all the immigrants came to. And being Irish and knowing that nationally Irish are, I think, now moved to third from second most illegal immigrants in our country, while mine came over at the first potato famine, I'm still, and have a lot of friends who are first generation. And why are we even, I guess I'm concerned, why are we even asking where they were born if they're here legally? They're whether or not they're citizens, they're on a proper green card or whatever. Some of the top researchers in our state are foreign born, very important to our state corporations. So I guess why it seems like we're almost, you're talking about a dragnet that concerns me, almost like why are we looking at where they, first of all, why we're, it's just incredible to be looking at where they're born, but then even if they're on a green card or some status that they're not a, that they may be citizens and still foreign born. So I guess that doesn't seem to provide much reason to me for a bill like this, which is going to greatly invade all kinds of people's privacy. If my parents just came over, I certainly wouldn't want people stopping and them to check on them. Where are we going? This seems incredibly broad.
Sheriff Stanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Mulley, I'm not, is there a question in there, or yeah. Can you rephrase the question succinctly?
Well, Mr. Chairman, please. I thought I was making so that you'd understand my question, I was going through what it was about. Why are we picking up and invading the privacy of everyone who might have been foreign born or something? And in fact, I know people who are second and third generation who still have, let's say, an Irish accent or something like that. Suddenly we're starting to investigate anybody walking down the street that we might think is somehow foreign born. That seems pretty strange to me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Mulloy, I think I can answer part of that, and then I think Representative Barrett wants to answer from a different perspective, maybe the front end. I'm not talking about walking down the street to stopping someone, asking for identification, a green card. I'm talking to you about what happens when they are booked lawfully into a incarceration facility like a local jail, in this case the Hennepin County Jail. Everyone that is booked, you know, we ask self-notification where they were born. We're required to notify the consulates of foreign-born individuals, and we do that, as I testified earlier. That's why we ask that question. That's one of the reasons. But that's one of the key reasons why we ask that question. And I think Representative Barrett wanted to answer.
And Representative Barrett, just so everybody knows, we're on House File 358, and the things that are contained in there, I don't know where some of these other things are coming from. And then if we stopped asking questions right now, we'd be less than 2 minutes apiece for our testifiers on this list that are in opposition. So the more we talk, the less we're going to hear from the opposition. So Representative Barrett, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. You took the words right out of my mouth. The bill, as we have in front of us, does not address that issue at all, doesn't mandate or require anything related to asking questions about whether you're foreign-born or not. It simply allows our police officers, our security folks to do what's right if they see a situation where they want to or should communicate to federal authorities. And it also allows them to do their job without interference from mayors and city council members. So the issue of foreign-born is not related to the bill as I see it. It's a good question, though.
Representative Moran?
I'm going to let the testifiers testify.
Okay, if I think we have one more person in support out there somewhere, and then
show up.
All right. Now we'll, Representative Barrett, is it okay if you, do you need any more statements before we go into the opposition?
No, just you should have in your packet a couple statements from two people in support of the bill. I hope you do. I haven't seen your packet, so I don't know for sure, but I think the police chief of Duluth has some information in there. And then some information in support of the bill from Ruthie Hendricks, who is the president and founder of Minnesota Seeking Immigration Reform. So you do have that. Please look at it at your leisure and use that to address any issues or thoughts you might have regarding the bill.
Okay, we want to hear from everybody. We'll go down the list. I believe Robert Allen, Minneapolis Deputy Police Chief, is up first. And we've got another bill that will probably...
He is in support.
What?
He's not the first on the list. No, but he was in support.
Oh, there was other guy in support. I'm sorry. I would ask for you before, but you didn't stand up. Come on up.
Huh? 2 minutes.
I don't know yet. We've got to bank 13 people. We've got another bill I think we can get done in 15 minutes. So I have about a half an hour. So can you limit it to a couple of minutes apiece? And then when you're done, the 2 minutes are up, I'll just wave at you. And otherwise, we're going to have people that don't get to talk at all that came some distance. So, your name and title. And go ahead.
My name is Norm Buhler, and I'm with MUIR. That's M-U-I-R, Minnesotans United for Immigration Reduction, also affiliated with Ruthie Hendricks' group and all the other groups in the state, and by extension, every state has such groups. And So I can feel confident that I can speak for all of those people, and that amounts to millions. But anyways, just limiting it to Minnesota, this is part of a, this particular bill deals with one of the inconsistencies of what is oftentimes euphemistically referred to as a broken immigration system. We should not have sanctuaries where illegals can congregate and not be concerned about having to divulge the fact that they're here illegally. There are a lot of aspects to this story, one of which is, if I may remind you, several years ago, then Governor Tim Pawlenty said that illegal immigration is costing the state about $178 million. If anybody has a better number on that, I stand corrected. That's just dollars, though, but, you know, they're pretty important at this time trying to deal with a state deficit on spending. We do, part of that $178 million goes for things that are very obviously designed to encourage illegal immigration. Central Campesino is one of those, just to give you an example. But let's go down to the southern border and take a look at what the human costs are. A few years ago, the number was about 3,000 over the previous 10-year span of time. People who were found dead and are along our southern border. These are generally Mexican citizens. We don't like that. Also, we don't like what's going on along our southern border that has led Arizona to pass their very tough immigration bill. So there's that cost. Then there's the matter of Border Patrol people who have been killed, because with these illegals come another very sorry tale. And that has to do with the drug running. These people, some of them are campesinos and trabajadores, farmers, workers. Those are what I would call the innocent ones. But they are also being used to used as mules to transport drugs across our southern border.
You could kind of wrap it up, sir. I know it's okay. Frustrating.
In any event, we don't like our Border Patrol people being shot at and killed. And so there's a lot of baggage that goes along with this illegal immigration. And if you don't like 358, then you also have to recognize that you are buying into all of those extra costs of lives lost that we that are just unacceptable. They're immoral. Besides that, of course, there's an inherent conflict with federal law, and that's not acceptable either. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you very much, committee chairman and committee members.
Thanks, sir. Robert Allen, Deputy Police Chief, Minneapolis. Welcome, sir. State your name and title for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Try to keep a couple minutes, it'd be great.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name's Robert Allen. I'm a Deputy Chief of Police, Minneapolis. Minneapolis takes crime fighting very seriously. In 2010, Minneapolis hit a 27-year low in Part 1 crimes. Year-to-date in 2011, we're down more than 25% in Part 1 crimes from last year. If you commit a crime in our city, we will work very hard to make sure you are held accountable for that crime. And we don't work alone. We partner with numerous other local agencies, county agencies, state agencies, and federal agencies, including the FBI, U.S. Attorney's Office, ATF, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I am confident that if ICE listed the agencies with which they had partnered on investigations in Minnesota, the Minneapolis Police Department would be near the top of the list. As you heard from Sheriff Stanek, if you get taken into custody for a crime in the city of Minneapolis and you are in the United States illegally, Immigration and Customs Enforcement will be notified. Be assured, Mr. Chair and committee members, that the city of Minneapolis does not want criminals in our city and will aggressively seek prosecution against criminals for all crimes they commit, whether they are United States citizens or undocumented. This law, however, is a bad idea. It limits the ability of a police chief to direct the resources of the department. If the police chief decides that we need a policy of greater enforcement against motorists who don't yield to pedestrians, and an officer decides that he or she prefers to spend his or her time enforcing federal immigration law, this bill prohibits the chief from limiting those activities. This bill also prohibits the city from limiting the investigative activities of any of its workers. If a building inspector has a hunch that some tenants of a housing complex he or she is inspecting, that inspector is allowed to start running the immigration checks on those tenants rather than focusing on the job of doing building inspections. If a receptionist is curious about the immigration status of someone visiting a city office, the city can't prevent that receptionist from contacting ICE or even starting a database on the immigration status of visitors to that city office. It turns out that conducting investigations is difficult, and the privacy rules for maintaining investigative databases are incredibly complex. So it would be very easy for someone who is not thoroughly trained in doing investigations or maintaining databases to violate privacy laws or commit some other civil infraction. If that were to happen, the city would be liable for the actions of its employees. Yet this bill would not allow the city to limit the action of those employees to avoid incurring that liability. This is not a fiscally conservative bill. This is not an unfunded mandate. It is an unfunded lawsuit against the city in waiting. I would also mention that the liability that the city is likely to incur would also apply to the state of Minnesota for the activities of all its public workers as well. There are, I'm sure, plaintiff's attorneys who are very excited about this bill passing. This bill also puts police officers in the potentially horrible position of being accused of racial profiling. What is the basis for investigating a person's immigration status? Is it their race, their speech, or as one Arizona senator suggested, their choice of clothing or footwear? The currency that police have in solving crime is the trust of the community we serve. When a crime occurs in the city of Minneapolis, the police often cannot solve it unless people in the community are willing to talk to us.
Sir, how much of your time you got left here?
About 30 seconds tops.
Okay, sounds good.
The fact that we were able to solve a triple homicide in Minneapolis last year was largely because we had done a lot of work in the Somali community developing trust. The fact that we solved the drive-by shooting that left a teenage girl paralyzed was because we had developed the trust of people in the Latino community, and we treat all our citizens fairly. I urge you to not pass this bill and continue to allow our police officers to do what we do best, police our community. Thank you.
Deputy Chief, do you have people at your desk that aren't thoroughly trained? You had mentioned that people you're worried about that weren't thoroughly trained. What did you mean by that? Giving out information. Do you have people at your desk that aren't thoroughly trained in what they can say?
There are city employees, building inspectors, receptionists, and so forth, who we do not train in investigative practices. And this bill would allow... would not allow us to prevent them from conducting those investigations. We have police officers who are well-trained and understand our policies and procedures, but the bill, as written, covers all city employees, not just police officers.
But do you think that these secretaries or whatever there would conduct investigations on their own?
There's nothing that limits, according to this bill, there's nothing that limits or allows the city to limit them from doing that.
Well, that would be like saying there's nothing to allow a secretary to go out and hit somebody in the head with a nightstick and drag him into jail. I mean, it doesn't seem to make very much common sense. Just because it doesn't prohibit some for you, it sure doesn't condone it or suggest that they do it. I was just trying to get at that. Well, it just seems like the House File 358, it's just reading so much into it. Like if it says that we'd have to list all the things in the world that a secretary or receptionist couldn't do, in this, in your opinion here, it looks like. not trying to belittle your testimony or anything, but it's confusing that the bill we're on, I can't read that into the same thing that you're reading into it.
Mr. Chair, actually, Minnesota statute would prohibit a secretary from hitting somebody over the head and dragging them to the chair. It's 609.222. It would be assault. And there are laws that specifically outline the requirements of making a citizen's arrest and the use of force. And cities like Minneapolis have policies to set up to make sure that people don't violate those laws.
Yeah, I see what you're meaning there, but what I was trying to get at is that taking on the actions of somebody else, either a firefighter or a policeman or somebody, I didn't mean just go out and wrap anybody they felt like, but arresting somebody. And so you'd have to do an unlimited amount of exclusions if you had it your way. I'm just trying to figure out where you're coming from. So, all right, thank you. Representative Mowry.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't do very much labor law, but the little tiny bit I know that that's not really correct is because the city can tell them you can't do things outside the scope of your duty here, but in this case this bill is saying they can't tell them that with respect to this, so it's a very different situation.
Yeah, I guess we disagree. Everybody in government, the city or county, has got a job description. If they fall out of that job description, do something they shouldn't do, they can be disciplined or fired. So Representative Mariani, we're down to about a minute apiece on people here. Sorry for taking up the time.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a very important issue. I hope that we're not just simply trying to rush important testimony from our law enforcement officials in order to meet some strict deadlines relative to an important bill. But let me just, first of all, I want to thank the chief for his testimony here today. I appreciate your presence here. But I do want to just very quickly, Mr. Chair, refer you to line 1.13 in the bill, which says, or in any way restrict a public employee. And I think as we write laws, we need to be very clear and very explicit about what we intend to do and what we intend not to do. This is pretty broad language. We'll, I suspect, come back to this language when Representative Barrett comes back up after all the testimony to see if that's really the intent that Representative Barrett wants here. But I think the chief here offers us a very important cautionary note relative to what I think, I believe, is pretty broad language that's going to put him and all other law enforcement officials in this state in an awfully difficult position relative to their ability to manage their departments.
Thank you, Representative Mirani. Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And Carolyn Jackson, my friend from the ACLU, come on up.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm the lobbying coordinator for the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members statewide. Crime is falling in Minnesota. According to the Minnesota Uniform Crime Reports from 1999 to 2009, the overall crime rate dropped 12%. The total number of arrests reported were comparable to the number of arrests in 1974, and the per capita crime rate was equivalent to the 1968 crime rate. We oppose House File 358, which would outlaw non-cooperation ordinances because local enforcement of immigration laws leads to increased racial profiling, illegal detentions, and decreases public safety. Law enforcement agencies that participate in immigration enforcement may be incentivized to make arrests based on the race or ethnicity of the arrestee, or to make pretextual arrests of suspected undocumented immigrants to perform an immigration status check. Black and Hispanic Minnesotans are already disproportionately entangled in the criminal justice system. It is the policy of the state of Minnesota to eliminate barriers to racial and ethnic fairness within the criminal justice system, not to increase it. In such disparate communities as Utah, Florida, and New York City, local enforcement of immigration policy has led to unconstitutional detainers of suspected immigration violations. Courtesy pre-detainer holds have been employed in violation of the Fourth Amendment prohibition on unreasonable seizure of people without a warrant. These pre-detainer holds are not reimbursed by the federal government and, if implemented in Minnesota, will expose the state to expensive litigation. Outlawing separation ordinances can lead to greater costs for local officials. Finally, tearing down the wall between local police and federal immigration enforcement makes our communities less safe. While police and sheriffs can testify to the effect of the risk of detention and deportation will have on public safety, the ACLU would like to add that this is a problem raised by law enforcement anywhere in the United States where bills like House File 358 are introduced. Currently, local governments have the option of shielding their police officers from the costs, racial impact, and public safety risks of local enforcement of federal immigration law. We encourage you to vote no to House File 358.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions for members? Appreciate it. Next up is Chief Tom Smith and Senior Commander Bill Martinez, St. Paul Police Department. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. I'm going to speak very quickly. I realize that you're pressed for time here. I will tell you that I'm very well versed in this topic, and I offer to each one of you that if you would like to speak with me offline, I'm actually working on some federal initiatives right now dealing with just this topic.
Your name and title, sir. I'm sorry, I forgot to ask you your name and title for the record.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm talking too fast.
Go ahead.
Chief Thomas Smith, Chief of Police for the St. Paul Police Department.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm working with Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, as St. Paul has been picked as a city that is a model to look at as far as different types of new immigrant groups that live right here.
Everybody want to check their cell phones and turn them off? Okay, sir, go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. We don't want that to happen. Very easy to turn off here.
So again, I offer those, I can talk with, speak with anybody offline about some of the things that we are proactively doing right now. Number one, St. Paul is a safe city, and we are not a sanctuary city. I want to clarify that. I think some of your other law enforcement speakers and Assistant Chief Allen address that, but we are not a sanctuary city. We may have a separation ordinance, but we're not a sanctuary city. There are some cities throughout the United States that people talk about are sanctuary cities. Here we equally enforce the law. I want all committee members, and all since we're in the capital city, equally enforce the law with everybody, with law violators, regardless of race, creed, color, it doesn't matter. Let me give you my talking points very quickly, and this will be very quick. House File 358, the proposed bill would prohibit immigration law enforcement non-cooperation ordinances and policies. The impact to the City of St. Paul would be to repeal of Chapter 44 of the City's Administrative Code, which states that police do not ask about immigration status unless it relates to the crime committed. Just so you know, we had general orders within the St. Paul Police Department even before that chapter was enacted. Undermine public safety by deterring immigrant communities, both victims and witnesses, from reporting criminal activity to law enforcement officials. Very, very important, because if the word gets out that police officers after an arrest or during an interview might ask somebody what nationality, what their immigration status is, that word's going to get out immediately. It's also redundant, because I think you heard from Sheriff Stanek, along with our own Ramsey County Sheriff, who is not here, but the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office asks those same questions when a prisoner or a suspect is booked into the county jail. Dismantles a community policing program that works. Since the enactment of the city's ordinance, Part 1 crimes dropped in the City of St. Paul by 12.1%, notably 37.5% in homicides and 21% in rapes. I don't know if people understand what the real fiscal impacts are if we go down this road. With the city, that would be additional fiscal costs in the city that would not be reimbursed by the Department of Homeland Security or the federal government. Unfunded man proactively enforce civil immigration laws. No additional funding for our local police officers to spend more time collecting information, arresting individuals, increase arrests for fake IDs from college students, increase penalties for possessing fake IDs from gross misdemeanors to felonies. This legislation, and I have a breakdown, and I think that you may have it in your packet. If not, we will get that to you. That would cost just the St. Paul Police Department to train all of our employees new computer systems so you could ask some of these questions after a person is arrested or detained, millions and millions of dollars. I won't get into the specifics here. expose the city to significant civil liability by requiring law enforcement personnel to make complex legal determinations about individuals' immigration status and deportability. Police do not understand the complexities of these various stages of a person's immigration status. A person can lack immigration documents one day, then secure them soon thereafter, or their status can change from one protected status to another. Police and administrative staff would need ongoing immigration training to decipher this, and I would just suggest to this committee that that is starting to go down the line of 287G, which in some states has been very controversial. I won't go over that here, but is allowing officers to enforce federal immigration laws. It's something that I am totally opposed to as a chief of police. I've worked all over this country. We've got a good thing going right here in Minnesota. We have some of the largest immigrants populations and new immigrant populations right here in the city of St. Paul. We do tremendous outreach work. We're recognized by the federal government. We've had people from the White House come and look at what we're doing right here in St. Paul because we have communities of trust. I don't want to break those communities of trust. This is the first step to do that, by asking questions. It's very, very difficult. We don't want to do that. I'm going to end with a quick story. I could tell you many more things. Again, I'm rushing very quickly here. 2010 in October, many of you probably saw a large article in the paper about a national sex trafficking case, human trafficking case, that the St. Paul Police Department was the lead on. We worked with actually the United States Attorney Van Vincent from Nashville, Tennessee, and numerous other agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security. It went through Jerry Vick's, the Sergeant Jerry Vick Human Trafficking Task Force. 4 years ago, girls as young as 11 years old in the Somali community were being trafficked. I've looked at those indictments. Horrific crimes. All of you would be appalled if you saw what went on for 4 years. As young as 11, 13, 15. But I'm going to tell you something personal, because as an assistant chief, I was part of that investigation. Why was I part of that investigation? Because we have a relationship with that community. And because a mother and a father came forward to me to tell me that their daughter was disappearing for 2 weeks at a time, their 13-year-old daughter. That's because of a partnership of trust. It took a long time to get that partnership of trust. And because of that, we helped that federal investigation move forward even more vigorously, and more people were indicted. 29 people indicted. On the flip side of that piece, again, we've got immigration people that work, ICE, a part of that immigration. There are three people still in the wind. One is out of the country. But other people were found out when they were booked and indicted, whether they had immigration issues or not, and they were dealt with accordingly. So again, I caution all of you that this is not the proper way to go down this road. I could talk about every community of color in St. Paul. I won't do that. I'm very passionate about this. I'm sorry that I'm rushing so quick. Again, I'm very well versed in this topic. If you'd like to talk with me offline, I can tell you all the things that we're doing right here in the city, which is a model, by the way, for the entire United States. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Martinez. I'm a senior commander of the St. Paul Police Department.
1 minute.
Yes.
You actually just used up time for about five people on the last testimony. It's good testimony, but you're going to make it so that people can't testify today if we keep taking so long, when 2 minutes means 2 minutes. So, all right. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, immigration enforcement forgets one important aspect, is you can't tell by looking who's legal and who isn't. There are nearly 11 million naturalized U.S. citizens and more than 25 million native-born Americans of Latin American or Asian descent. In this free nation, we are not required to carry papers to prove our citizen status, and few of us do. If enacted, this law would encourage race-based ethnicity profiling, because police are ill-equipped to determine who has violated civil immigration laws due to the administrative nature of the violations. Some will inevitably stop and question people of certain ethnic backgrounds who speak certain languages or who have notable accents. These actions would set the U.S. civil rights movement back decades and introduce a slippery slope in the quest to eradicate the racial profiling that we've been working so hard to address. And I know that a lot has been said here about the Mexican community and the drug trafficking coming in from Mexico. And I think it's easy to point a finger at somebody that looks like me, as he's probably a trafficker. But it's simple, basic microeconomics. If there wasn't a demand in this country for the meth, we wouldn't have the problems that we do now. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, we've got Bruce Nestor, immigration law attorney.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Nestor. I'm an attorney in South Minneapolis.
Couple minutes.
I just want to say, I mean, I work every day with people that are so casually referred to in this room by some people as illegal aliens. I've got to tell you that you're out to talking about your student, your kids' classmates in school, their parents. You're talking about people that serve you every day in the hospitality industry. You're talking about fathers, mothers, brothers, and human beings who help keep the economy going in this entire state. You're talking about the future of an aging state, too, in terms of our workforce. I just want to speak to this proposed legislation, which really appears to me to represent more of a political agenda in search of a public policy rather than actually being a public policy. First of all, the statute accomplishes very little because it basically mimics existing federal law, 8 U.S.C. 1373. It's really where the language is borrowed from. The most significant change in this legislation is that it actually then inserts that language into the State Data Practices Act by putting it in Chapter 13. And, you know, one of the principles of the Data Practices Act is a principle of limited government. It says that the state only collects information and then only uses personal information when it's necessary to a government purpose. And this bill basically eliminates that restriction of the Data Practices Act with respect to a single class of information, immigration status. And it says that that information can now be collected for any reason, and it can be disseminated, and that a local government cannot put any policy over any public employee to prevent the dissemination of that information. And that seems to me to be the antithesis of a principle of limited government, which is to expand the power of government without any sort of legal restrictions to gather and disseminate personal and private information. And then really the other major change that this would have over federal law is to create a private right of action. And that means that any individual could sue any state or local government, any entity, if they believed, it doesn't have to be a lawsuit with merit, but if they believe that that entity was somehow restricting the sharing of information. I actually would challenge the bill's authors to find a single policy or ordinance or regulation or law currently in the state of Minnesota which violates federal law and which violates this law. Yes, you know, where's the need?
You're about a minute over already.
Where's the need for this legislation? Is it a political agenda or is it public policy?
Thank you much.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
This is an extremely important issue to some of our communities, mine being one, and it affects the safety of our people. And so cutting short testimony such as this, cutting short people who are police chiefs and deputy police chiefs from the two major cities, I just don't think is appropriate. In looking at the fiscal note, it's one of the most absurd fiscal notes I've ever seen. It doesn't have any, even an input from the court system, and yet we're allowing anybody at all to institute lawsuits. It's got no local costs, and yet we've had the chief from St. Paul, chief of Minneapolis, say there's going to be a huge cost to them. I think, first of all, this is a fiscal committee. We need to know what we're doing on the local costs and maybe Smith's committee, Representative Smith's committee for the judiciary. But I think if we're running out of time, we should carry the bill over to allow it because this is such important to people in my community, and mine isn't the only one around the state that this affects our actual safety, as the two chiefs eloquently put, but they were even limited on time. So,
well, you and I are using up more valuable time now, but I've been here 9 years. We go through this every year. Every single year, we come to a bill where people are begging for more time. We just plain run out of time. If 50 people would have signed up today, we certainly wouldn't have had a hearing for 3 days on this subject. There'll be lots of other important controversial subjects.
and we're going to end up voting on this before noon, and so the more we talk, the less people are going to get to testify in opposition. Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess we're going to have to talk then, because it's pretty apparent that this committee has no interest in hearing from the outpour of public concern over this bill. Mr. Chair, this bill was actually scheduled, a month ago, 6 weeks ago? And the chair pulled it from the docket. We certainly have plenty of time during this session to have the intense discussion that this bill deserves. The history, you and I have been here for a while. We've seen this bill before. It has, in fact, had very intensive, and appropriately so, regardless of where you're at on this issue, because of everything that's at stake here, it's had much more proper vetting than what the chair is proposing to have here today. And to have here today in a committee where we have, I don't know, one-third easily of our members who have never served in this legislature before, have never had the benefit of hearing from the police chiefs of Minneapolis and St. Paul, or anyone else who wants to testify on this issue. And so it's pretty clear to me, Mr. Chair, we're not going to get through this list, because otherwise these individuals are going to have to come and offer 5 seconds of testimony. That is not a good public process. And so, Mr. Chair, you are the chair. I've been a chair. It's a tremendous responsibility to be a chair. It's also tremendous power. If you want to hold this bill over so that we can continue to have the conversation with the public, that would be the appropriate thing to do. That would be my counsel to you at this point.
Thank you. Next testifier will be Michelle McKenzie, Director of Advocacy, Advocates for Human Rights.
In light of all this, I will endeavor to be speedy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Michelle Garnett McKenzie. I am the Director of Advocacy for the Advocates for Human Rights. The Advocates opposes HF 358 because it jeopardizes the safety of immigrant and refugee crime victims by undermining their ability to seek law enforcement protection. Immigrant and refugee crime victims have a right to safety and security, including protection by the police, and to access to justice regardless of their immigration status or how they came into this country. HF 358 rests on a fundamental misunderstanding of what separation ordinances and policies are. As you've heard, they do not create sanctuary cities, and nothing is farther from the truth. These policies were developed by police departments themselves to encourage immigrant and refugee crime victims to turn to the police for help. They assure victims that if they report a crime to the police, they will not be interrogated about civil status violations if they have not themselves committed a crime. If they have committed a crime, that territory is wide open. Fear of deportation too often prevents immigrants from seeking protection from law enforcement and impedes an effective response to victims of crime. The U.S. Department of Justice notes that criminals are known to target immigrants because of their known reluctance to report crimes. We know that members of this committee share a deep concern for the safety of human trafficking victims in our state. Human traffickers prey upon the vulnerabilities of their victims, including fear of deportation. Our research indicates traffickers confiscate immigration papers, misrepresent our immigration laws, and threaten their victims with arrest and deportation as part of the coercion and control they exercise. Fear of deportation also has a powerful silencing effect on immigrant victims of domestic violence. While undocumented victims are most vulnerable, we know from our research that even in cases where women have legal immigration status, abusers deliberately lie to them and use fear of deportation as another weapon of control. Fear of removal is so great, many immigrant women do not report violence to anyone, even family, friends, and neighbors, for fear someone will call the police. These ordinances help cities carefully balance two very important interests: the need to cooperate with federal immigration officials against the need to ensure victim safety, and that everyone has meaningful access to security of the person, due process, and equal protection. This bill undermines that balance. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. Tommy, you're here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Tao Mei Shong. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and I'm actually not going to be testifying due to time. I'm going to have a program shelter director testify instead.
Okay. Go ahead, ma'am. State your name and title in a couple of minutes, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sipra Cha, and I'm the shelter program director for the Asian Women United of Minnesota. It is the only domestic violence program and shelter in the state of Minnesota that has special expertise working with Asian women and girls, but we serve all women and children who walk through our doors. In fact, a large number of the women we serve are immigrant women from all over the world who walk seeking assistance to escape violence. Many battered immigrant women come to our program because we are culturally and linguistically sensitive to their needs and concerns. As a result, we understand the unique and complex barriers that battered immigrant women face, and so I'm here today to oppose HF 358 because it will discourage battered immigrant women from leaving their abusers and force them to continue living a dangerous life. For battered women, the police are the first line of defense in violent situations. Battered women need to feel safe calling the police for help when they are in danger. Immigration-related policies and practices that directly hinder a battered woman's access to law enforcement creates a dangerous and ultimately deadly situation because what policymakers and the general public do not realize that many battered immigrant women are abused by their citizen's spouse or partner. The batterer, who is a citizen or legal resident, uses his legal status as a means to control, manipulate, and exploit the immigrant woman by threatening her with calling immigration, not filing her immigration papers, or hiding her legal documents, just to name a few tactics that they use. In our shelter, we often see batterers who intentionally force the woman to go out of legal status in order to maintain control and power over her. In one situation, a Cambodian woman named Hiep came to our shelter after her husband had abused her since she arrived in America. He would force her to have sex with him several times a day to the point where she couldn't walk for days. He would often beat her to the point that where she was dizzy. If she tried to hide in the closet or bedroom to escape his beatings, he would threaten to kill her. Hiep had no family in Minnesota. Her husband brought her here, so she didn't know anyone and she didn't understand American culture, especially their immigration policies. She doesn't know anything about the system.
Ma'am, could you finish up here?
Yes, sir. It's an important. So her husband often threatened her to kill with calling the police to put her in jail, and that in American jails he would tell her people are killed. He oftentimes threatened her with terminating her immigration papers and sending her back to Cambodia to disgrace her and her family. Luckily, she received help from her husband's American-born niece. She called the police, and the police helped her escape her abusive husband. She credits her survival to the help and support of the police. Her story is not unique. Unfortunately, we see this happening with immigrant women from every racial and ethnic background. Batterers use immigration status as a means to control and abuse the victims. And if this law goes into effect, sir, battered women, immigrant women will
Ma'am,
be forced
you'll have
to live
finish,
in fear.
You'll have to finish up now. We've got a number
this
of people.
Bill, I'm concluding, sir. This bill, if passed, puts battered immigrant women and children at serious risk of harm and potentially death. Please do not support this bill. These women need your help. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. Is there a Virgil Wiebe in the crowd?
Your first attempt was correct.
Okay. We have your handout, so if you could keep it short, we've got your handout. So.
My name is Virgil Wiebe. I'm an associate professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. I teach immigration law and supervise students in representing immigrants. I would just highlight a few things from my report and also respond to some of the issues that have been raised thus far.
Can you do all that within a couple minutes?
See what I can do.
Okay.
With respect to local lawsuits or the potential for costly lawsuits, I disagree with Chief Allen. He spoke earlier that plaintiff's lawyers are excited about this. I was on the phone with a plaintiff's lawyer in Georgia last night, which has recently passed a similar law to this. He spent a significant amount of his own resources opposing a bill like this. But yes, indeed, he will be challenging it in Georgia, and it will cost somebody money to defend it. So there is that, on the one hand, creating policies that govern when city officials may inquire or keep records concerning immigration status might open up a locality to a private suit. On the other hand, localities might be sued for failing to control the actions undertaken by overly zealous local officials. Privatizing immigration enforcement by way of citizen suits is a bad idea. This bill does track some federal language. Notably, the federal statute does not allow for private lawsuits, and Congress has explicitly decided not to create separate remedies for private citizens under that federal statute. You know, one question that's often rhetorically bandied about is, what is it about illegal that you don't understand? You know, I'd invite any of you to come to some of my classes, because it does take more than 10 minutes to sort out what is it about illegal that it is not to be understood. It's difficult to sort out someone's legal immigration status and the concerns that were raised by some of the police chiefs about personnel out of within law enforcement understanding immigration status, let alone other city or local officials deciding on their own to engage in basically investigation and enforcement of immigration laws is problematic at the least, and probably reserved for federal immigration authorities. I just end by saying that there was mention of Oklahoma, Florida, and Georgia taking steps like this. Recently, Kansas, Nebraska, Tennessee, and Kentucky have rejected legislation like this. That's the way this is trending.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Yes, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to get this in before we rush through this and I don't have a chance to speak. And I would like to say that I sit here in opposition of this bill for many, if not all, the reasons that we have heard today. But as I sit here, I'm trying to understand why this bill is in Public Safety Committee, because I have not heard any support of this bill to say, as written, that it will create safe streets for us in the state of Minnesota. It blatantly takes away local control. The bill is mandating that local elected officials and police chiefs must do what they must do, and is taking away their ability to govern their community as they see fit. And I just, for the life of me, cannot see how we can introduce a bill in a public safety committee that is about creating safe environments when this bill is taking away that ability for our law, from our law officials to do the work that they need to do to create safe streets for all of us in the state of Minnesota. And so again, I won't repeat, you know, I can say it's about, you know, racial profiling, it's just been blatant, but I won't do that because I'm going to stand where we are in this committee around safety, and we've heard from the experts, and I think we need to take that into consideration when we look at introducing the bill. And I'm sure Representative Barrett's intentions are good, but the way this bill is crafted is not creating safe streets.
Representative Higgins? Yeah.
I'll wait till the
final
testimony.
Okay, next testifier would
well,
be
Mr.
From...
Just per, Mr. Chair, just inquiry. Yeah. Is it your intention to finish the testimony and vote today, or are we talking about this evening?
And we'll probably run over a little bit in the noon hour here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next testifier will be... I can't pronounce the names. Petrenko is the last name and Burstein is the last name. Are you both going to testify or?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Vera Burstein. I represent the Jewish Community Action.
And I am Lyudmila Petrenko with the Jewish Community Action, and Vera asked me to translate her testimony from Russian and read it for her. I came to Minnesota from Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union. All my life there, I didn't have any trust for the government or the police. I remember seeing people removed from their beds at night and moved to prison because their neighbor reported them as public enemy. I came to this country because I was looking for freedom and trust between citizens and authorities. I came here because I wanted to be a part of a strong community. I am against this bill. It will instill fear in me and my community. It will ruin the trust that I have built with my neighbors. It will turn my life into what we ran away from. the life of mistrust, fear, and false accusations.
Is that your testimony then?
That's Vera's.
Okay, thank you. If there's any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mingo Mendez, small business owner. You take off. Gloria Frisia? And we have heard from the Battered Women's Coalition here. Have you got more?
Battered Women Legal Advocacy Project.
Okay, could you
keep,
go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Chair, some members of the committee. My name is Gloria Frisia, and I want to thank the Chair for allowing me to testify. I am a managing partner of the Battered Women's Legal Advocacy Project, a statewide nonprofit with 15 years providing legal advice, training, and assistance to victims of domestic violence, as well as legal advocacy attorneys and other professionals serving them. Our mission is to promote justice for battered women and children. I am here today to oppose the proposed Bill 358 because it has serious implications for the protection of victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and other violent crimes. In particular, the proposed bill will negatively impact immigrant victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. As you know, battered women face a myriad of challenges when trying to escape a violent situation, and when you add the element of immigration status to this picture, it makes those challenges even more insurmountable. For more than a decade, the federal government has recognized that immigrant victims of abuse and exploitation have unique vulnerabilities and should be afforded relief. The Violence Against Women Act, VAWA, since its creation in 1994, has included continued to expand protection to certain battered immigrant women. These protections are intended to help them, battered women, regardless of their immigration status, escape violence and achieve safety. Unfortunately, this bill, if passed, undermines the progress made through VAWA and once again subjects victims of domestic violence to living in fear and intimidation by their citizens or legal resident batterers. I want to add here that many of those battered women are entitled to be totally and absolutely legal in this country, and if they remain undocumented, it's because of the will of their abuser partners.
Are you about done, ma'am?
Sorry?
You about done?
No. One okay. More second?
Quickly.
I think I have. The moment the people are afraid to call the police, society is less safe. It is important for policymakers to recognize that these policies have serious public safety implications, not only for battered immigrant women, but for Minnesotans in general. Denying protection to a segment of our communities creates an unsafe environment for all of us.
Thank you very much.
I have copy for the members of the committee.
Okay, we'll have a page to take a look at them there and bring them up here. We've only got three testifiers left, so I think we want to have a problem finishing up here. The next one is Catherine Crothers, No More Children Left Behind.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Crothers. I founded No More Children Left Behind. My background, I'm a New York State licensed French, Spanish, and ELL teacher. I taught for a year with a temporary Minnesota ELL license in the South Metro. And it was at this time that a reality facing many of our students and families and my fellow educators was brought to my attention. And that led to the formation of No More Children Left Behind. We have approximately 7% of all of our K-12 kids nationwide have at least one parent that's undocumented. So what happens as a mandatory reporter? Most of these kids, if there's any risk that they're at harm, teachers have only assurance that good things are going to come out of making that phone call.
Ma'am, could you restate that fact you gave? How many students out of how many are undocumented?
6.8% as according to a report of Passel and Cohn, 2009, are members of a mixed status family, which means that they have at least one undocumented parent. It doesn't go into siblings, just one undocumented parent.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. Teachers are supposed to provide professional education services in a non-discriminatory manner. Teachers are supposed to make reasonable efforts to protect the student from conditions harmful to health and safety. There's no guarantee that a child is going to feel comfortable seeking resources from school support staff if they're worried about the unity of their family. As a mandatory reporter, you're asking educators to potentially risk decimating the unity of a family by making a report that may or may not have merit. And I conclude my statements. I'm opposed to this as a parent, as an educator. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Is that it, ma'am? Did you want to say something, young lady?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You say your name.
My name is Susie Crothers. I am an 8th grader at McGuire Middle School in Lakeville, Minnesota. And I'm here on behalf of myself, my fellow classmates, and our society. I have some major concerns on this bill, because if this bill is passed, if an undocumented child wants to report a crime that they know about, will they have that trust with the police officers to be able to go there without risking their security of their status and risking losing their family, friends, and their home? Also, this wouldn't just affect them. This would affect me and our society. Our communities wouldn't be as safe if they wouldn't have crimes being reported by everybody who knows. What about our schools? Well, if a student has problems with their peers or families at home and they want to talk to a school counselor about it, would the school counselor be obligated to investigating their status? I believe that all children should be able to trust our superheroes of our society. With this bill, trust wouldn't be there between classmates and government agencies. Please make policies establishing trust with police and schools. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, young lady. I appreciate your testimony. All right, we have one more testifier, Ann Finn. And then we'll go into discussion and vote after that. Good morning. State your name and title. And
good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. You'll note that the page is right now distributing a handout that I brought to make some of the points that I'm making today. I have 3 points I'd like to make on behalf of cities. First is, the League does not oppose placing responsibility on local law enforcement agencies to cooperate and communicate with federal authorities on matters involving illegal immigrants. We believe that most, if not all, local law enforcement agencies are enjoying good working relationships with federal authorities at the present time, and I think you heard that today from the law enforcement community. I would respectfully ask that you consider my next 2 points, which are concerns the League has with House File 358. The first is this. While the League acknowledges the responsibility of our law enforcement officers to be attentive to federal immigration laws, we also want to underscore our position that immigration enforcement is primarily a federal government responsibility. We would oppose any shifting of this burden and related costs to the local level. We would not want the provisions in this bill to enable any kind of shift in this responsibility. Finally, this bill may have ramifications beyond the law enforcement community. As was noted earlier, in lines 1.13 and 2.11, there are references to, quote, a public employee and, quote, employee of the political subdivision, respectively. What this means is that the political subdivision cannot impose policies that restrict when any employees may inquire about immigration status of any members of the public. Our concern here is that this bill may cause a chilling effect on interactions between city staff and residents. We want the residents in our communities to comply with local ordinances, such as obtaining building permits, paying water bills, and licensing their pets. Compliance with these ordinances is important to the quality of life in communities, and when people are afraid to walk into City Hall because they may be asked for documentation, they simply won't comply. Further, we believe it's the employer's prerogative to determine that it is not an appropriate role for city clerks and public works employees to be asking members of the public for proof of legal immigration status, as this bill would appear to allow. Thank you very much, and this concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Ann Finn. Members, public testimony is over, and we'd invite any questions or comments. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative Gauthier. Oh, yeah, Representative, can we go to Grunhagen first? We passed him up before. Representative Grunhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a co-author on the bill, I just wanted to respond to some of the testimony, pro and con. The, what a tangled web we weave when our federal government will not enforce our immigration laws in this country. And, you know, one of the reasons I signed on to the bill is to try to discourage illegal immigration into the state of Minnesota. We need legal immigration. Legal immigration has been a tremendous blessing for this country, economically, culturally, socially, and in so many other ways. But illegal immigration is bad for this country overall. But you know who suffers the worst from illegal immigration? The illegal immigrants themselves, okay? And the reason is because they put themselves in a position legally in this country where they can be exploited and used by other people for self-satisfaction or personal gain. We've got to come up with a better system. We cannot perpetuate this system anymore, which is one of the reasons I signed onto the bill. The other thing about me, I've spent a significant part of my life on a voluntary basis trying to help people that are in a worse situation than what I am. Some of them illegal immigrants, so I have no bias or racism towards anybody. But I see the system as broken, and that the very people that are suffering the worst under the current system is the illegal immigrants themselves. And then we have well-meaning people like some of the police people that testified who are trying to make the best of the situation and to work with these communities and to do what's right. And I empathize with that, and I appreciate that. On the other hand, we have to stop create a legal system, in my opinion, that discourages more and more illegal immigrants from coming here and putting them in this situation. So somehow we have to change the system to allow people to come here illegally and then to create incentives such as this sanctuary city, which I know there's some debate on whether to call it that or not. But that's one of the reasons I signed on as a co-author, not to be against any particular group, okay? But to send the signal that we have to change this system, and we have, and federally, that's another story, and we've heard testimony about some of the results on the border, the murders and the drug trafficking and everything else, but also to help the illegal immigrants themselves from coming to a situation where they set themselves up to be exploited. So that's why I support the bill, and that's why I signed on as a co-author. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Grunhagen, this is not the Federal Immigration Committee. This is the Public Safety Committee. And what I've heard from our leaders in the community, particularly from St. Paul, where I reside, is that this does the opposite. This does not help public safety. It hurts public safety. It hurts the city of St. Paul. It creates a public safety hazard, a public safety problem. And why in the world, Representative Barrett, would we be wanting to pursue this when it creates more public safety problems and does not do anything to solve them? That I don't understand. And I don't understand when we're cutting St. Paul, and Minneapolis I'm sure is the same, we're cutting LGA by millions. I think it's $23 million over the last 3 years. I see another 12.6 proposed for 2011. We're going to come forward with a bill that's going to cost, according to the City of St. Paul, another $8.1 million to pursue when it's not even going to help public safety, but it's going to hurt public safety. Can you explain to me why we're pursuing this? It makes absolutely no sense.
Representative Bear?
Representative Chair Cornish, Representative Johnson. It's my belief we currently have a public safety problem. We have millions of undocumented people. Some of them are victims of crime. Some of them actually produce the crime. We know that because we've heard testimony from many, many people. We've had triple murders. We've had sexual assaults. We've had human trafficking. We have that now. So I believe this bill will help prevent that. That's why I authored it.
Representative Moran or no? Gauthier, and then Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, one of the things we need to be careful about is unintended consequences, and when we pass legislation, and we can talk about not our intent, but the bill clearly says that no local government shall prohibit or in any way restrict a public employee from doing any of the following with respect to data regarding immigration status. And so what we are actually doing, members, you know, is we are telling people of color to watch out, because now we're going to believe that you're all illegal and you're subject to any type of investigation, whether it be a clerk at City Hall or the police officer on the street, you're a target. And basically, and I don't think this legislation lives in a vacuum either. It fits right into gutting the Department of Human Rights. It fits into voter ID. It's a comprehensive attack by the people on the other side of the aisle, because they don't want to deal with the reality of what causes immigration. You want to cut the programs that address that, drug treatment, because we have a drug problem in this. We don't look at corporate farmers in southern Minnesota that hire illegals. Where is that? I haven't heard any of that from that side of the aisle. But what we have done is target people in urban areas and people of color. And I just think this is reprehensible, and it does nothing, absolutely nothing, for public safety. What it does do is tell a significant part of our population, legal or illegal, be in fear of your government, because we're going to start asking you to prove your status, whether you're here illegally, first generation, or 25th generation. That's what this bill does. And this needs to go down in flames.
Representative Gauthier, in answer to that, I guess, then we'll get to the next question. I figure that I won't name any names, but I think there's a lot of people without courage at all to address the illegal immigration situation. And what I mean by that is, right now we've got hundreds in our jails, obviously hundreds in our schools. We've got thousands committing crimes, but yet you don't want voter ID, a simple picture on an ID. You didn't like my illegal documents, whether people could carry 5, 6, 7, 8 illegal documents, you didn't support that. And it was even proven there by the cop that testified that they prey on illegal immigrants more than they do anybody, these illegal immigrants that are doing this. And you don't want us to ask questions in cities or be able to ask questions. So with voter ID, with this bill, with the illegal documents bill, there's absolutely nothing you want to do. You just want to throw your hands up in the air and say, well, if the feds can't fix it, we're just going to let it go. Minnesota's got a huge target on its back for illegal immigration. They know when they come here, there is no emphasis to enforce immigration. And they know that benefits here are very easy to get. Well, I know that's true, Representative Mariani. You see, you're shaking your head. But in law enforcement, you talk to them, and you ask the people where they're coming from. They'll name the city. They'll name the town. And they come to Minnesota. There's lots of reasons to come to Minnesota for illegal aliens.
Well, Mr.
And it
Chair,
just happens to be a fact. So,
well, Mr.
I just
Chair,
wanted to
I guess I
comment like in a, back into your statement.
Well, I guess I'd like to retort that. We have a system that seems to be working. We heard a sheriff talk about people being taken with, asked if they're foreign born and being interviewed and deported. We heard that. We heard that from the Department of Corrections. This is a bill looking for a problem. And I, quite frankly, think it's targeting, you're right, there's a target on the back, but it's a people of color.
We've got two in the list first, Mariani, Mullery, and then Gruner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barrett, line 1.9 of your bill, it says designee. Can you tell me what a designee is?
Thank you, Representative Mariani. I believe a designee would be anyone acting on the authority of a government entity.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, if the City of St. Paul contracts with a sewer cleaning service, would that be a designee as defined by House File 358?
Representative Mariani, no.
Well, but Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, based on your answer, they would be contracted to do work, presumably, they're getting a public contract for a public good. It seems to me that that fits your definition, and if it doesn't, then perhaps you might want to tighten up the language on designee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, thank you. I will consider that advice.
I think it's good advice, Representative Barrett. Representative Barrett, earlier, I thank you, and I just want to make sure you have the ability to correct yourself on the record. And I apologize if I misheard this, but I think you said that the Duluth chief, and you know we have the letter here from the chief of police of Duluth, was in support of House File 358. As I read the letter from Chief Rand, well, I just want to make sure we're clear. The letter from Chief Ramsey, it does not appear to be in support. So if I misheard, but I just want to make sure as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, if I said that, I stand corrected by your testimony. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Barry, it could well be that I misheard as well, but I wanted to make sure. You know, members, I know that we want to get out of here. It seems like we're not listening to our local law enforcement officials, who have the largest numbers of immigrant populations in the state, including presumably largest numbers of undocumented and mixed family in the state. And in fact, I thought, my chief's eloquent testimony of his experience regarding the Somali, with the horrific Somali sex trafficking case, which, members, didn't involve only simply undocumented people. And that's kind of the rub here, you know. We talk about us versus them. I can tell you, a few years ago, on your side of the aisle, you had a member who's no longer with us, I'm not going to name him, good fellow, good representative, who came to me when I had the DREAM Act bill. And he struggled over this bill. And the reason he struggled was because he had a son-in-law who was undocumented. Now, how did that happen? Did he jump a fence somewhere? You know, did he raid our shores? No. You know, he's a human being, and human things happen. His beautiful daughter went to Mexico to study, fell in love with a Mexican national, and married him. Now, if we had hours, we would hear from a number of expert immigration lawyers here. I think this is what the law professor from St. Thomas was trying to carefully warn us about. When we talk about a broken immigration system, what we are talking about is a system that put that daughter and her beloved in a position where they would have had to wait 10 years because they fell in love and impetuously got married right away, 10 years to enter the United States. 10 years. So what did they do? Well, they did what any human being is going to do. They're in love. They're married. He came into the United States undocumented. He lived, was reciting, in the house of my GOP colleague at the time in which we were debating this bill. Not because he wanted it to happen, but because his daughter was in love and married someone who he loves as well. This is the reality of immigration in this nation. We can put our heads in the sand all we want. We can stereotype. We can misrepresent what's going on out there. The fact is that this nation right now, under a Democratic president, is evicting far more undocumented people than ever before in the history of our nation. a Democrat president evicting undocumented immigrants far more than President Bush did at the height of his work in this area. And so to say that we aren't working hard to crack down on undocumented immigrants is simply not true. The issue before us is that we are talking not about us and them, members. We're talking about us. We're talking about my family. Yes, I had an undocumented brother-in-law. We're talking about our communities. We're talking about making our streets either safe or not safe. I don't know about you. I really honestly don't know what folks are thinking. I've got reputable law enforcement officials telling me that you have to have trust in order to do your work well, but somehow we're smarter than they are, and we're going to turn over the office keys to their office, to their rank and file secretaries, to dictate how they're going to police their entities, their cities, their jurisdictions. Members, I don't blame anyone here. Representative Barrett, we have a huge issue in this nation in regards to immigration. I don't spite you at all for attempting to address it. This is the wrong way to address it. This is the wrong venue to address it. The state is the wrong place in which to address federal policy. What we need to do is reach across the aisle with one another and hammer out an agreement for us to lobby our federal officials where there's going to have to be give and take, like Ronald Reagan did in 1986, where there's going to have to be give and take, but this can be done. This is not the way to do it. We're creating much more harm. I know you don't want to create harm, Representative Barrett. I've gotten to know you. You're a decent fellow. But that is what this legislation is going to do. And, you know, if the majority wants to pass this, then so be it. You know, we'll enter into the public debate, and you explain to the people of Minnesota how you just made our streets less safe in Minnesota, because that is what our law enforcement officials are telling us.
Okay. We are going to, public testimony is closed. Make a record of who we've got on the list. Representative Mullery, Grunhagen, Kiefer, and Moran. Tomorrow we'll hear from those four and only those four, and then we will end the discussion and take a vote, and we'll lay the bill over until tomorrow at 10:15. And is there any other questions or comments? If none, meeting adjourned.